seek out as best one can a creative, mutually supportive interdisciplinary team. Mm. And that sounds nice, and it is nice. It makes for a wonderful academic life, but there's actually a literature behind it. Mm-hmm. Hollingsworth, for example, performed studies involving academic institutions and overperforming in major scientific awards like Nobel Prizes, Field Medals, Lasker mm-hmm. Awards, those sorts of things. And his research absolutely found that those overperforming groups certainly were interdisciplinary, certainly mm-hmm. engaged in lots of ad hoc, outside of work time mm-hmm. engagement. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't only sound nice, it actually does produce creative risk-taking science. Yeah.
Welcome to the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing podcast, Aging Fast and Slow. This podcast is supported by the National Institute on Aging Pioneer Award. Thanks for listening. We are Dr. Sarah Zanton
and Dr. Deidre Cruz, your host. For anyone new to our podcast, we speak with scientists, policy experts, and innovators to better understand aging across the life course, with a special emphasis on the sustained impact of racism on health, the impact this has over the life course, and what can be done to tackle these inequities.
Measuring structural racism in health poses challenges due to its deeply embedded and systemic nature. The multifaceted aspects of structural racism, encompassing policies, practices, and cultural biases, make it really difficult to capture through traditional metrics. Measurements often demand innovative methods that account for both historical and contemporary disparities.
In today's episode, we're stepping into a realm where measurement and insight meet. We have the honor of welcoming Dr. Karen Bandine Roche, a distinguished biostatistician who has mastered the art of quantifying the unquantifiable. Dr. Bandine Roche guides us through her expertise in measuring elusive variables and how this could illuminate the measurement of structural racism.
So to get at structural racism, we start with asking you about your work in measuring frailty. Frailty, like structural racism, is both a cause of other outcomes and an outcome itself. It is really difficult to directly measure, and it's multi-component. So while it may seem different than the ways of measuring structural racism, we're hoping to dive into what can be learned from your extensive frailty work. Welcome, Dr. Karen Bandine Roche.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We're thrilled.
Yeah.
So first, just to jump right in, can you explain for us a bit about your research in measuring frailty and its importance in the field of biostatistics and healthcare?
I can try, and I loved your term of elusive variables, yeah. actually. And so we could ask everybody listening to imagine a frail person. And I think that everybody probably could do it. And some of the commonalities I would expect would be that it involves low energy, slowness, weakness, things like that. Also some things that are hidden, underlying problems with health that manifest in some ways better than in others. And so my work is focused on capturing those sorts of outcomes, devising strategies for measurement, and then evaluating how well they succeed in determining what we're after. So that's my general research in measuring frailty, is applying those ideas to frailty. The importance in the field of biostatistics is really the development of those methods. Some people who are listening may recognize the term latent variable models. That latent basically means an elusive or mm-hmm. an underlying health state in the case of frailty. And so methods to develop measurements of those sorts of things, we call them constructs, continues to be very important. And in healthcare, frailty has been called the raison d'etre for geriatric research. Mm-hmm. It's been recognized since the time at least of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare in As You Like It refers to the man whose clothes had become a world too wide for his shrunk shank. So it really has been a concept around for a long time. And recognizing frail older adults both helps us to guide their health care optimally, but also we'd really love to prevent frailty altogether so as to extend healthy life.
That's beautiful.
Oh, wow.
So to help us end up towards measuring structural racism, what would you say are some of the key challenges you've encountered in measuring frailty, and how have you addressed them in your research?
So I can think of two. One is that we can define frailty fairly precisely as a state of vulnerability to adverse health events and outcomes, which are underlined by a medical syndrome involving weakness and slowness and low energy and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the actual indicators that we use to get at those elements of frailty tend to be very imprecise. And so just dealing with that measurement error is one big task in developing and assessing measurements of frailty. And the sorts of models that I referred to a minute ago really help us do that. The second that we've recognized more recently is what I would call differential criteria. Those are aspects of frailty that seem to manifest very differently in different groups of people who otherwise seem to share the same level or state of frailty. And so we've identified these in particularly problematic in different racial and ethnic groups. And so I think it's very germane to our conversation today.
Great.
Yeah. So frailty, as you've certainly shared already, is complex and it's a multidimensional concept. So how, when you're thinking about what to measure in the space of frailty, how do you decide what to include in your measurements, and how do you weigh the relative importance of those different things?
Absolutely. So to use a jargony term, collectively that process is called validity. And that is just determining whether one's measurements succeed in ascertaining the target that we seek to measure. Mm-hmm. And so content validity has to do with selecting measures that span the various aspects of the definition without including extraneous elements. So that's the very first step. Then we try to ascertain whether the measure that we've constructed predicts things that logically it ought to predict. So frailty is about vulnerability. It better predict who's at risk and who's not at risk. And then finally, what we call construct validity has to do with whether the measurements theoretically behave as they ought to. And so, for example, if we hypothesize that frailty is a syndrome, then measurements ought to co-occur in a general way rather than in specific subsets that might suggest different diseases underlying different presentations. And to address the last part of your question about relative importance, certainly part of our evaluation is tied to their overall performance and the validity aspects that I just mentioned. But it's interestingly sort of an oxymoron in frailty, given that at least some definitions of frailty really hypothesize that frailty fundamentally is a co-occurrence of criteria across these domains. And so better performance of some than others, I think one has to be quite careful about.
Well, and, you know, people talk about intersectionality a lot, like that if you're at the intersection of being, let's say, Indigenous and with a disability, you know, and a rural area, that's a very different thing than not being at that intersection. And it's interesting to think about the intersection of weakness and slowness, for example, that's a different thing. You don't just control out for the slowness and then it's something different. That there's something about the intersections, in a way, just to use a term that some of the listeners might have thought about, too.
I love that analogy, and I think it's extremely apt, just the way you said it.
Does the way you measure frailty, has that evolved over time?
It's evolved a little bit, but interestingly, it has not evolved a great deal. And our group talks a lot these days about the potential need to evolve it. And the current measure of frailty that we use is a very clinically oriented measure. And so it emphasizes simple measurements of things like speed and weakness and whether one feels exhaustion and so forth, which may be very effective in a pressured clinical setting, but not as effective for research or for screening early or those sorts of things. So we've been talking about measurements that better capture what some people call functioning in the wild. Mm-hmm. So to actually measure physical activity using an accelerometer or et cetera, rather than asking people. We've also talked about more deeply physiological measurements. You might think of that as sort of an endophenotype, meaning an underlying measurement. So indeed, those are some of the things we're talking about.
So, of course, all of this work that, so many of us do is certainly a team sport. So what do you feel like have been some of the key things that your group has learned from working with others who work in the space of frailty measurement?
I think a very important thing that we've learned has been that people think of the term frailty in different ways. And so there are indeed many different measurements of frailty. They often are connected to different concepts of what frailty is. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very useful. They just happen to be different than the one that we have pursued in our group. And so recognizing that and learning to even better tie what one measures to either the concept that we intend to measure or the purpose for which we intend to use the measurement has been a big lesson from others.
So, Karen, frailty is likely developed across the life course. Someone doesn't become 85 and then they're suddenly frail, unless something, you know, sometimes someone does, they break a hip and you hear about the sequelae from that. But given that likely it develops across a lifetime, how do you account for that in the measures, or how are you thinking that one might account for it?
Well, I think an embarrassing answer is we have not accounted for it as much as we should, given what an important topic it is. Mm. However, we have been able to use midlife data. So one key answer is the critical importance of data which span different phases of the lifespan. The atherosclerosis risk in community study, for example, began in midlife but has been followed for many years. And so now those individuals are older age. And we've pursued a number of studies, for example, demonstrating that inflammation in midlife is pretty strongly related to one's frail or non-frail status in older age. And so that for sure is one answer to keep pursuing work like that, to keep developing data that can address that critical topic.
So transitioning us to the topic of structural racism, can you draw upon kind of any parallels between the various challenges and opportunities that you've encountered in trying to measure frailty, to think about how that could impact efforts to measure structural racism and its impact on health outcomes?
I believe so. I think as you have envisioned, there's sort of a surprising analogy. One is that neither frailty nor structural racism can be measured by any one variable. It's inherently multidimensional. A second is the presence of measurement error. We would love to have the most ideal indicators of structural racism as data that we could, but in practice, we simply don't, or at least we don't know a priori which ones really have been measured as very effective indicators and which ones perhaps are measuring lots of other things and have have a lot of error. And so I believe that some of the same methods may be very useful. The importance of first defining quite carefully what we mean or how we intend to use a measure of structural racism, then to develop measures that relate to that theory or those ideas, and then methods potentially like latent variable models, but others can help us to both address the measurement error, to assess how effectively the measure performs at measuring what we intend to measure. And then in thinking about our time together today, I just realized the one other thing might be differential measurement. And we've talked about it, that at different parts of the life course, for example, different indicators may be the most apt ones of structural racism than at another point in the life course.
Like air pollution when you're six might be more important than air pollution when you're 50 on later health outcomes, for example.
Yeah, and you know, just to build on that a little bit, it occurred to me when you were sharing how kind of the origins of the measurement of frailty, the majority of the measures are actually clinical measures or things that can be done in the clinical setting, and how at least the things that we are so far conceptualizing as things that we can use to measure structural racism are very much not things that the typical clinician is going to do in their office, right? And so I don't know if that's something that for you raises different challenges or what your thoughts would be on that.
I think so, because many of the indicators are publicly available data. And so there's so many challenges with that, certainly complete measurement, perhaps some regions in the country more rigorously measuring things than in other regions of the country, less under our control, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it really does pose fascinating additional challenges.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of fascinating additional challenges, how do you think the field of biostatistics can contribute to developing more effective strategies to measure structural racism?
Absolutely. So I've alluded to some of, of the ways. I do believe that latent variable models, which hypothesize an underlying construct that we wish we had all the power and clarity to measure, but don't, and so how to utilize imperfect measures is one way. But there are some additional ones. Life course is critical. And so models that effectively use measures at different parts of the life course to predict outcomes in a way that allows for differential importance at some parts of the lifespan than others, it is definitely one.
Right. So if you had measurements of weakness and slowness and exhaustion at age, you know, 45 and 60 and 80, you know, it'd be interesting to see how you would weight those or look at those in terms of a life course of frailty and frailty prediction.
Well, absolutely. And we've done just a tiny bit of that with age, for example, and thinking about the oldest old, older adults versus younger old, older adults. And there's at least a hint that gait speed has differential implications earlier than later, because by later, it's almost inevitable to have slowed down a bit. And so other measures then come into play potentially as differentiating people more.
So all those fast New York walkers, I bet none of them become frail.
No, that's possible. But that, you know, but the corollary is we're talking about how the comparing the frailty measurement to structural racism measurement. It's interesting because there are some scholars that would argue that when you encounter structural racism, right, in the life course, probably makes a difference too. And it probably is in a similar way that that younger person, even that younger older adult who may be, maybe they're still in the workforce, maybe they're still engaging in society in ways where they may encounter more of the sequelae of structural racism, they may have different, I would think, different effects on their health than, than an older person who's not encountering it as much. So
if you look at immigration work, you know, where a lot of African immigrants will say, you know, at home, I didn't think of myself as black. I thought of myself as a woman or a villager or a, you know, and you come here and it's like, this is your identity. And
That's there's lots of literature on that. Immigrant.
And where in the life course that happens.
I think those are wonderful examples. And so biostatistics has a great deal to contribute in terms of determining implications of structural racism for health, accounting for all of those considerations. And then I think the one other thing I wanted to mention, just because it's so interesting, has to do with networks of mutually reinforcing systems. And so as I understand definitions of structural racism, the role of not just disconnected structures and systems, but systems that interact and mutually reinforce each other is very important. And so network modeling holds great promise to try to capture those sorts of implications.
Yes. And for our listeners, we sometimes talk about we've learned how to model the weather. It's not exactly right, but you can know that a hurricane is going to be worse because the water temperature was higher in a different area and El Nino is coming from the west. And we should be able to do that with structural racism over time.
We can hope. So there's a lot of excitement, although some concern, about what machine learning and other artificial intelligence approaches might add to lots of things in the field of health and medicine. So where do you see either of those contributing to our understanding of frailty or to our understanding of structural racism?
I think that those methods have tremendous promise to help us discover the unexpected, things that theory miss. So we can have a very, very elegant theory that doesn't make it true. And if we're forever only bound to theory, you know, we may miss important determinants of health or important implications for health. And so machine learning, AI are great at identifying either predictors that are very strongly implicated and we might not have expected, or perhaps substructures or ways that elements of structural racism may go together, which are fundamentally different than we expected, and may then lead us to alter our theories and go on from there.
Made me feel less worried then about
these things. So you've mentioned theory a few times, which is so important in terms of deciding what to measure and how to measure and when to measure and among whom. And I wonder if you might talk a little bit about either frailty in theory or how you see theory fits into the life of an important measure.
Absolutely. So in situations where no one gold standard measure exists, and particularly when we're in the realm of needing to use multiple imperfect or imprecise measures to capture an overall or a multidimensional construct, it is critically important to first determine what it is one seeks to measure. So that's the critical role of theory, because then that guides everything else, the choice of measures, determining whether that measure succeeds in the purpose, and certainly evaluating whether the measures perform as one intends them to. So in frailty, for example, our specific theory is that frailty is a medical syndrome which is driven by physiological dysregulation and results in vulnerability to adverse outcomes due to syndromic dysregulation involving muscle integrity, energy production and use, and stress response. And so with a definition like that, immediately the sorts of measures become clear. Also things we shouldn't include. You didn't hear chronological age. You didn't hear cognition. Yeah. And that it also guides the performance as expected because of those elements of being a syndrome, that sort of thing.
Right. And then when do you loop back and revise theory? Like if it turns out that cognition is really important in it, which I know it is not, but there's also a feedback loop at some point to rethink theory.
Absolutely. And so in the frailty context, if best attempt measures leveraging that theory continually were poor at identifying individuals who were vulnerable, but perhaps they could be better, then that certainly would implicate re-evaluating the theory.
So you've led a incredibly distinguished career and have contributed so much. And I know you've already mentored so many people who are up-and-comers, but we're curious about what kind of advice would you offer to the next generation of Dr. Karen Bandine Roches who are out there who may want to tackle some of these really tough questions?
As I reflected, knowing that you're going to ask this question, what came to mind was to seek out as best one can a creative, mutually supportive interdisciplinary team. And that sounds nice, and it is nice. It makes for a wonderful academic life, but there's actually a literature behind it. And so Hollingsworth, for example, performed studies involving academic institutions and overperforming in major scientific awards like Nobel Prizes, Field Medals, Lasker Awards, those sorts of things. And his research absolutely found that those overperforming groups certainly were interdisciplinary, certainly engaged in lots of ad hoc, outside of work time engagement. And so it doesn't only sound nice, it actually does produce creative risk-taking science.
That's beautiful.
Sounds fun, too.
I don't know if this was in the Hollingsworth study, but I think building a diverse team in terms of rank and ethnicity and life experience, I would assume, would be part of that.
Absolutely. You know, so I used the word interdisciplinary, but heterogeneous in lots of dimensions. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Can you share one of the most valuable pieces of advice you've ever received?
Yes, and this actually came from my PhD advisor. So it was long ago. And what he constantly told all his students is to remember that science is a marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. And so this is both the scientific literature and beyond. It's not enough to have a great idea that one absolutely has to communicate it in a compelling and engaging way.
Mm-hmm. And you do, as you've just shown in the last half hour.
It's been a tremendous pleasure, Sarah. Thank you for those very kind words. And it's been a joy to collaborate with you and with you, Deidre, all these years. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Karen. I've looked up to you since my first semester of PhD program, so that's a long time. Your insights into measuring the hard to measure have enriched our discussions on the challenges of measuring the causes and impacts of structural racism. To all the listeners, check out our website, nursing.jhu.edu/agingfastandslow, for the articles and resources referenced in the episode. And if you have comments, questions, or guest suggestions, reach out to us at agingfastandslow@jhu.edu.
And if you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with a friend, rate it, or write us a review. Special thanks to Jennifer McCord for editing and sound design, Rafe Reggie and Florentina Kostaka for technical expertise, Brian Fitzek for production, and Tim Carl and Danielle Kress for web design. See you next time on Aging Fast and Slow.